Numbers on top, yeah. And then?
Person.
So the red light goes on. Okay.
Schools and etc. And she was brave enough to want to sit there and filter it all and translate it all into the struggles and, that she had in her life. Until she finally approached me one day and she said, "Can we start a Masurvad for single girls, for my friends?" So I said, "Great." We just started it 2 weeks ago. And last week, just a few days ago, as we were sitting in Yerushalayim in my living room, they were talking about Hishtadlut in this context. And one girl said something very insightful. She said, "You know, I feel like I walk around and people are being very judgmental of me. If only you would have done something a little differently, you'd be married by now." And she said, "You know, when there are other struggles in life, when people have a medical issue or something like that, people don't point a finger and say, 'If only you would have, you know, eaten more healthily, you wouldn't have this issue.' But somehow in this stage of life, people feel that everyone's always trying to figure out, okay, what's she doing wrong?" And she said, I want to be accountable. I want to work on myself. But I don't want to feel that people are looking at me and thinking, what am I doing wrong?" So that's why I added something to this. Because when we do Hishtadlut, and this is really more of a bitachon concept even than a dating concept, but it's so important. We do Hishtadlut because we're in a partnership with Hashem here. And He's working and I'm working. But not because I can point a finger and say, would've, could've, should've, and that's why things aren't working for me. It's so important. And it's even a little bit of a challenge because the Altar of Kelm talks about this. He says, it's interesting in life in general that you do Hishtadlut, but you know that Hashem controls outcome. But the actual doing of the Hishtadlut seems to sometimes confuse you because, one second, maybe I'm controlling outcome. And here a person is, let's say in a work situation, you're writing out the resumes and you're making all of your contacts, but you're supposed to remember that I'll get exactly the job that Hashem wants me to get at the time that I have to get it. And nowhere is this more true than the year of Shidduchim. I can take responsibility, I can work on removing obstacles, but I'm not pointing a finger at myself and saying, you see, if only you would have done that, then things would have been different. Because Bitachon and Hishtadlut work together. And the Altar of Kelm says something very interesting, an interesting imagery he says. He says it's like saying to a person, it's difficult. It's difficult to do Hishtadlut and remember that Hashem is still going to do this for me exactly at the right time. He says like this, he says, it's like saying to a person, Shvor et achavit u'shmor et yayna, which means break the vessel and hold in the wine. The wine is Hashem is exactly navigating my life and will send me the perfect person at the perfect time. That's the wine. But the glass is the Hishtadlut that I'm doing, which is holding in the wine. But as soon as I do Hishtadlut, it's almost like I'm breaking that picture. 1 second, wait, who is Hashem controlling outcome or am I controlling outcome? And he's talking off of the Mesilat Yesharim that says that I have to do my Hishtadlut, but I also have to keep in mind that I'm not blaming myself for anything. I'm doing my part and Hashem is doing His part. And this is so important because we're going to talk about removing obstacles. And as we're removing obstacles, Hashem will bring it at exactly the time that was meant for me. I think that I'd like to just add one little point about this before we move on. The question that sometimes comes up is, well, then why do Hishtadlut b'chlal? If Hashem will bring me exactly the right person at the right time, why not just sit back and wait for it to happen? And that's true in any area of life, you know, career, health, anything. So there's a few reasons for this. I'll just give two. And some of you maybe have heard me speak about this topic before. One of them is, as a result of Chet Adam HaRishon, before Adam HaRishon, we were given everything on a silver platter. After Chet Adam HaRishon, we were told, "B'zeat apecha tochal lechem," which translates loosely into our lives as you have to work for what you earn, for what you're going to get. So basically, as I'm doing Hishtadlut and Shidduchim, and we just said that, you know, the private Hishtadlut that we do, it's like I'm paying a tax for Chet Adam HaRishon. It's not that I'm controlling, and it's not that I'm pointing a finger at myself and saying, "You did this wrong, so correct it." It's that I have to pay a tax of Chet Adam HaRishon, and Hashem will bring me the right person exactly when He wants to. That's one reason. There's another beautiful reason that I'd like to say, and then we're going to launch into the actual things, the Hishtadlut itself. But the other one is something that Rav Olva says in Al Yeshur so beautifully. He says, why do we have to do Hishtadlut if Hashem is going to bring the outcome anyway when He wants? He says, it's because of Hashem's tzniut. Hashem likes to be private and hidden. So when I make efforts towards my own success, I'm like a smokescreen for His work. Because in order for there to be bechira in this world, people have to be able to point a finger and say, of course she got a good job. She's very, very bright. Or of course she got a good shidduch. She had all the right connections. Or of course she got better. She went on that special diet. So when I do what I have to do, I'm kind of helping Hashem be tzanua in the, because He really is controlling the outcome anyway, but I'm putting in the effort. So I'd like us to keep this in mind as we work, that we have to do our part, but He's doing His part at the same time. Okay. I think one of these phones, these recorders is ringing in case anybody needs to know about that. Okay. So let's go into this. So really, what do we want to talk about today? Okay. So let's start at the beginning. When I look at the process of dating, we're going to start with actually having the dates that we want to have. And then we'll follow a little bit through to the point of a developed relationship and making the decisions. So let's talk about the actual getting enough dates or having the right dates. Okay. So here, I think clearly is an area where a person has to do, wants to do his hishtadla, but also has to know that this is an area where clearly Hashem is navigating. What do I mean? Two people can do the same hishtadla, and one person will end up with 10 dates a month, and the other person might have 5 months without a date. Clearly a person who has 5 months without a date is saying, what am I doing wrong? And really, if we look at the bitachon part, as long as a person is trying and making the efforts to do what he has to do, this nisayon comes in different packaging. I say this often to different students. There's one kind of nisayon, going out with 10 guys in a month, and none of them are for you, and it's 10 times of getting dressed up, and being hopeful, and trying, and coming back, and it wasn't for you. And that's difficult. You didn't study for your test then, you didn't hang out with your friends then, it takes a while to get ready for the date, get to the date, get back from the date, and it was all seemingly not worthwhile time. Of course, we know that everything moves us in the right direction. And then you have somebody who sits home, and she has plenty of time to study, and plenty of time to hang out with her friends, but she's waiting for that phone to ring. And she's kind of wondering, what's wrong with me that the phone isn't ringing? And when I look at it from the outside, I say it's the same nisayon in two different packagings. Because both of them will meet the right person at the right time. Some people after investing more time. Some people after investing more worry. But basically, it's the same nisayon. And it's important for us to keep that in mind. I think that as we do hishtadlut to connect ourselves and to do whatever we have to do for the good of our shidduchim, we have to remember that if I'm just paying the tax of Adam HaRishon, I do it without anxiety. Where does anxiety come from? The would've, should've, could've's. I'm controlling outcome. So maybe I didn't make a good enough impression on that chachan, and maybe I should've worn a different outfit, and maybe I should've said something differently. If you believe that you're doing what you have to do because that's your hishtadlut, you do it without anxiety. I'm doing it thoroughly, I'm doing it responsibly, but since I'm not controlling outcome, there's no need to be anxious about it, because anxiety usually works against us anyway. Okay, so this is important to keep in mind. Okay, I think that one of the questions that comes up sometimes for some of us is not just the idea of how many dates I'm getting, but are the people I'm going out with appropriate for me or not? And there's that question of, he doesn't sound so right for me, but I know that it's really hard to be set up, and should I be going out with somebody who seems to, I have a question about it. And you have people who, you know, keep giving things a chance, and then they get burnt out by all the dates that were not at all relevant for them. And then you have the people who say no when ideas don't seem to be relevant, and then they wonder if they're being too picky. So we're trying to find the balance between the two of them. Okay. So first of all, one of the things that I recommend to people in terms of that is to, in your mind, have a certain sense of clarity about what I call wants versus needs. And wants versus needs is that I have a few non-negotiables, things that I really feel would affect the quality of my life, that I feel that if I'm in a dialogue with Hashem, He would say to me, it's impossible for you to marry somebody who doesn't have this, whatever this is. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then I have the things that are called wants, meaning it would be nice if he was this and this and this and this, but those are not the non-negotiables. what is the importance of having a list of wants if you're going to negotiate on them anyway? I'll tell you why. Because I feel that when a shadchan or somebody setting you up knows about your wants as well as your needs, it gives them more of a sense about you. I don't want to mention names here, but I made a shidduch one time, and Baruch Hashem, they're very happily married, they're a very special couple. And I thought of it dafka based on something on both of their wants list, not the needs. The needs often sound similar, because many from girls have certain non-negotiables that are very much alike. The wants are where you see the person's personality shining through. So both of these people were very, very musical, and they would have loved to marry somebody who was also musical, but they were smart enough to put it on the negotiable list. Even though this girl was saying to me, if I marry a guy who's tone deaf, it's going to be very hard. But she realized that if he's a tzaddik, then she'll handle his not being a tone deaf. And she married a tzaddik who actually was musical. But the idea was that the idea that music was on the list is what made me think about them, to think of them for each other. Not that they weren't willing to negotiate on that, but it made me think about it. So you are entitled, but if you're speaking to somebody who's setting you up, it's good to have it clearly delineated. These are the non-negotiables and these are the negotiables. Now, what goes on the non-negotiable list? The negotiable list is whatever you want, whatever's important to you. What goes on the non-negotiable list? I think that part of our problem here is that there's a lot of generic use of words that everybody sounds the same. I want a boy with your shemayim and good midos and good this. And you know, the shadchanim are kind of like yawning when you say that, because who doesn't want a boy with good midos? I mean, I've never heard of a girl who wants a boy who doesn't have good midos, right? So it kind of makes it all the same. And I kind of think, and I encourage people, that on the level of the non-negotiables, try to be a little more specific as to what your non-negotiables are. A concept like Yir Shamayim is defined very, very widely and means different things for different people. So I think that you could focus a little bit deeper into how you define what criteria, for example, do you consider to be absolutely necessary, or to flesh it out a little bit. Good midos also. Every single person in the world has some good midos, some bad midos. And here I'd like to get into a concept that I think is important. When you talk about the non-negotiables and midos, I encourage you to hone in on specific midos that you really feel that would be very, very, very difficult for you not to have. And those, I think, should be different for different people. And here I'd like to mention an idea for anybody who knows, has learned psychology, imago theory in relationships. It talks about the concept of people bringing out certain things in each other. There's somebody called Harville Hendricks who popularized on a more amcha kind of level, some of these ideas. And basically what we're trying to say, something very important. If a person, people very often seek out the familiar. And if the familiar to you is good familiar, then you'll be attracted to somebody who might be very similar to your family in a good way. I felt very nurtured growing up, and I'm going to end up marrying somebody very similar to that. But the thing that we want to hone in on, which is so important, is that sometimes people are attracted to the familiar even if it's not good for them. And there's a certain like ding, ding, ding that happens sometimes. It's like a baby who likes to hear the same song again and again, and people who like to have their security things and the pillow that they like. Sometimes people, when they go out with a boy and there's something familiar there, it creates a certain sense of connection. Now, like I said, that's great if the familiar is positive, but sometimes it happens even when the familiar is negative. Why am I saying this? On your non-negotiable list, I encourage people, it's not always so pleasant to do, but I encourage people to think about, is there something that I grew up with? Oh, okay. Should I make it? Okay. And this phone keeps ringing. Okay, who doesn't hear? Oh, now. Okay, that's much better. Okay, sorry, I didn't even realize what the capacity was. Thank you. Okay. So what I say is, instead of saying good midos, I think you have to define specific midos that are going to be very important to you. And this is true in the negative sense as well. Let's talk about this for a second. If you grew up in a very critical home, you might naturally, almost subconsciously, be familiar with a critical kind of a person. But that's dafka something that you're trying to avoid. So instead of saying to a shadchan, I would like good midos, you say, I really need a person who's very loving and accepting and not critical. Because chances are, this is like, I kind of say that this is your chance to rewrite a certain history. And if you grew up with something that was difficult for you, when you're dating, sometimes it has to be a conscious process to not marry somebody like that. And again, when you say good midos, your shadchan is yawning, because every single nice Jewish girl says good midos. But when you say, I need somebody very warm, not critical, easygoing, I don't know, whatever it is, specific things that are things that are important to you, then, and I say, if you have to hone in on them, think about what you grew up with. Think about what was helpful to you that when you grew up with. And think about things that are particularly difficult and harmful for you. And that is a much more specific, it helps the person setting you up hone in on something very, very important. Now, I feel here there's a balance between being flexible and between being strong about the things that are the basics. And basically, when we talk about where to be flexible and where not to be, I feel that if a shadchan has an idea, or somebody or friends has an idea that's a little bit out of the box, but fits the basic criteria that are very, very important to you, then I would say to give it a chance. I don't know so many people who regret marrying a boy who came from a different community or a different yeshiva or a different height than they would have thought of. Those are the negotiables. But I do know people who feel that it's so important that they honed in on the very specific things that they needed, because that would have been, that's essential. So what I'm saying is be strong about your core access, your core things that are so necessary, and be flexible about the packaging that it comes in. Okay, that's my basic idea here. But I think that the nistayon for many of us is the idea to see beyond the external trappings. In all my years in Michala and in different places, I've rarely seen a girl who's married a boy who is everything she was looking for. It's almost like Hashem gives us a little bit of a trade-off here. What are you willing to negotiate in exchange for what you really need? And very often, the nisayon is in areas that are a little bit on the periphery, but they still take an adjustment. And I feel like, in a sense, this is something that we have to be ready. We have to be ready to see a beautiful person in a not-perfect packaging sometimes. And that's where I do encourage people to be flexible, because so often a girl has married a diamond who came in a not-perfect packaging, and it was almost like Hashem says, here, I'm sending you somebody wonderful. Can you see beyond the packaging and see into the person? And this is where I really do encourage people to be open-minded. Pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Yutes, says, "Im tatzi yakar mizolel kafi tihiyeh," which translates as being, if you can see something beautiful inside something, a packaging that's not so beautiful, then you have the power of Hashem's mouth. The Gemara says on this pasuk, what does it mean, kafi tihiyeh, Hashem's mouth? Afilu HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes there, gzera, hu mevatla. That this person has a special koch to mevatla gzerot. There's something very special about seeing something beautiful in a not perfect packaging. And this is what people who are involved with Kiruv HaChokim, they're always seeing. There's somebody who is covered with layers of imperfection or impurity, and you see that beautiful neshama inside. I think that this is true in so many contexts, and I'm going to mention a few of them right now. First of all, the shidduchim that are very non-conventional. Being set up with somebody where there's an age gap, one direction or the other, maybe something in his background which is not simple. For some of us, at certain stages, it includes people who are divorced, people who are widowers, people who have health issues. What I think about those kind of things is you're looking at the core. Is if this person is everything I wanted, but there's something in the packaging that isn't perfect, there's a chance that you're really getting a diamond in a package. And I'm not saying this just because I feel like we have to encourage people to be open-minded. I'm saying this because almost every time I've had a situation with a girl called me and she was struggling over something in the packaging, she calls me back, sometimes a year later, 2 years later, and said, I feel like I got a diamond. And it's like almost like I wonder if maybe diamonds come in not perfect packaging sometimes, because there's so many stories like this. And this is just something to keep in mind. Okay, I'm going to get into the specifics a little bit with this as well, because what comes up a lot in our world is mental health issues, physical health issues that come. This is true about people of all age groups who are dating. But almost inevitably, there are certain patterns that I see in my counseling, my advice line. And one of the patterns that I see, it's happened so many times already that I can't even count, is somebody will call me up and she'll say, you know, it's so funny. I've gone out with a lot of boys who are really not so shy after me. And I finally being set up with this, I finally was set up with somebody. I went out with him a few times and then he dropped the bomb. What's the bomb? He tells me something about himself, either a physical health issue or some kind of emotional issue. And it's so ironic. The first boy I've ever liked, or one of the only boys I've liked, has some kind of issue. And again, because I said that diamonds often come in not perfect packaging, I'm not surprised. She thinks it's so ironic that this guy who she likes is the one who has the issue. I don't think it's so ironic on some level, but okay. They say in the army, in the Israeli army, kol ma shelo horeg michashel, which means anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So very often people who have something that they've had to work through in their lives become very, very special people. And maybe that's kind of why it's not so coincidental that that happens. So they just got the bomb dropped on them and they don't know what to do. So I always tell people in such situations, you have to differentiate between stigma and real life issues. Stigma is the ma yomru. What would my aunt say if she knew? That, I put a kind of like an X on that, because I think in life we try to look at things in a real deep way and not just about what would somebody say if they knew. But then there's the real life issues. And the real life issues is, how is this going to affect me? And here, I don't minimize. I think we have to be responsible. And as much as I say this person might be a diamond in a certain packaging, you still have a responsibility to be very, very, very careful and to know what you're getting into. The first thing I always say to people in such situations is, did he offer the ability for you to speak to somebody who handles the situation? Whether it's a doctor or a rav or a therapist. And I say either you have to refer to your person or you have to refer to his, preferably to his, in order to, and maybe both, in order to really, really understand the ramifications of the situation. How is this going to affect my life, immediately, long-term? And here, afterwards, there's a need to process that information. Why am I saying this? You might think this is so rare. It's so not rare. It's so common these days that I feel a need to talk about this because it comes out so often. So I do tell people that look into it carefully, but if you understand that this is an issue which you think that you can live with and live and be able to accept, then you have to really think about this. And I wouldn't necessarily just shun something because of that. I developed a certain system, which is not really only about these kind of issues, but it includes them. It's something that I call the continuum and the toolbox. What do I mean by that? I mean, anytime you see an issue or you suspect an issue in somebody that you're dating, you want to understand it both on a subjective and an objective level. The objective level is what I call the continuum. And almost every issue, especially a media issue or a mental health issue, has a continuum between 0 and 100, let's say, in my mind. Meaning, you saw a little bit of anger in this person, or you saw a little bit of lack of confidence, or you saw something. And you want to understand, is this, where is this on the continuum between people who have a nothing, no issue, a zero, or somebody who has a full-fledged issue which is going to really make your life very, very, very difficult? And I tell people, this is you have to become the detective now. You're watching. Some people, the second they see an issue, they're just so scared of what it's going to look like at 100 that they just say goodbye to the person. But really, sometimes after research, you understand that this is something in a moderately low range. And it's important to understand where it is. You know, I bring my students sometimes the example from the issue, just found a random example from paranoia. So on a zero, you have people who are not afraid of anything, fearless. We'll go into any situation, walk into Ramallah in the middle of the night, you know, whatever. Those are zero when it comes to some level of being scared or suspicious. And then you have the people who are generally pretty confident and trusting. But if they're walking late in some dangerous area and they hear footsteps behind them, they kind of turn around a little nervously and pull out their cell phone and call somebody. That's very normal. Then you have the people who do this in the middle of the day, still in a normal realm. Then you have the people who do this in their house where the doors are locked. It's already getting up there. And etc., etc. And then, unfortunately, at the high end, you have people who, I was once dealing with a certain woman, that every time she misplaced her wallet, she thought that one of her kids had stolen it from her. So that's high end. Issues with trust or paranoia. So that's just an example, but every time you see a chiseron in a person, you want to understand objectively, where is this issue? Anything which is kind of like heading towards the hundreds is something that, unless it's being handled very, very, very well and already seen success in some kind of therapy or whatever, is something that could make my life very difficult. And it's my responsibility to try to figure that out, both for my own research. This is, by the way, why good checking is so important. And I often say to people, go back to the people you checked with. Because when you're checking out a boy who you barely know anything about, you don't even know what to ask. But when you've seen a certain personality issue, and you go back to his rav, I wouldn't do this with his roommate or his best friend, but you go back to somebody who you think can be discreet, and you say, you know, I've noticed this and this. Can you help me understand the context for that behavior? You're much more likely to get a more direct answer than when you were just shooting in the dark when you were checking into somebody. But it's important to have a context to be able to check people out, because this is one of the ways you help get this information. I would encourage you, and I always say this to my students, that sometimes when you're making a phone call yourself, you could get good information. It might even be more helpful to try to, I feel like I'm facing this way because the mic is this way, but okay. Play some Jewish geography and have somebody who has a rapport with that rav or person you're calling make the call for you. I personally have had many very serious conversations with rebbeim and different yeshivas where they were unbelievably honest with me about what the issues were. So I think it's worth it to try to maybe reach out and have somebody help you figure this out if you need to. But the first thing, this is all getting back to the continuum. I'm trying to figure out between 0 and 100, how major is this issue? Then comes the toolbox. And the toolbox is the subjective tools that I have to deal with the issue. Like I said, anything which is high up is something which could really be very difficult unless it's being very, very well handled. But if it's on a lower range, it becomes a more subjective issue. Do I have the kelim to deal with this chiseron that this person has? Maybe my friend doesn't and I do, or maybe the opposite. We have to remember, girls, that no person is perfect. We're all marrying somebody with chiseronos. It's almost like there's an image of this guy, and there's a lot of bright, sunny, yellow lines that you could fill in all of his wonderful qualities. And there's a few black lines where you're going to have to fill in a few chiseronos, because even the Gadol Hador has chiseronos. So the fact is, it's not that I see a chiseron and I'm out of here. I see a chiseron and I want to figure out where is it objectively, and also subjectively, what are my kelim to deal with this issue? When girls call me up about a chiseron that they've noticed in a boy, and they say yes or no, right or wrong, break up or not, I say, you know what, a lot of this is subjective. What are your tools to deal with that chiseron? And that's the subjective part of understanding that. So when we talk about making concessions, and where to give up and where to break up, I think it has a lot to do with understanding, really, where is this person, where is the chiseron on an objective level, or where is it subjective vis-a-vis me? Okay. Revisiting old relationships. This is another question that comes up. Had a relationship, went further and was more serious and intense than many of my others. It didn't work out. Should I get this out of my mind, or should I possibly think about revisiting? Often comes up. I have a certain principle that I've developed, which is that even though it's tempting to rekindle an old relationship because we understood each other well and it's not like starting from scratch again, I tell people, hold off until one of you is in a very different place than... And if you just get back to dating the same person with the same issue and you have the same issue, you're going to like be excited to see him again, and then within 2 or 3 days, oh right, that's where we broke up. What'd you gain? So my principle is that it's only worth revisiting if somebody's in a different place. Either you know that something about him has changed, or something about you has changed. But this is not the same two people starting up again. This is the same two people plus a change. And sometimes that propels us to make the change that we have to make. And if it's a matter that there's something in my attitude that was wrong, I have to really seriously evaluate that. Or maybe there's something that I have to know that he did certain work. But it's so tempting when somebody says to you, let's just try again, to say, yeah, why not? But I would always ask that question, well, what's different now? What's different this time around? What's going to make it, sustain it longer than it was before? And it's a temptation because it's so easy to get back into a familiar situation. But if there was some reason why you broke up in the first place, you have to either say, that was a permanent issue that's not changing and I'm not going back. Or it was something not so major, but somebody has to be different here. Okay. Next. Who to go to for advice? Also comes up a lot. You know, the whole parental role. I'm a parent also. And thank you so much, Mother. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Parental involvement. Really, we have to ask the question about parental objectivity. That's really the question. How objective are your parents? Sometimes I feel that parental objectivity is like an oxymoron. How objective can parents really be? But yet, there are some parents who are very, very, very capable and able to be objective. I kind of feel that even if parents are not objective, they agree to be included to a certain, they deserve to be included to a certain extent, and they care about you, and they want to know what's going on with you. So even though they might not be your main source of information, they might not be the main source of advice to you, but you still would want to include them. So even if you have parents who are very not objective, you might just want to keep them in the loop because they're also suffering from wanting to know what's going on with you and caring about you. Parental objectivity for Jewish parents is an issue because I find that parents fit into two categories. The ones who can't wait to get you married and the ones who never want to part from their dear little bubala. And I don't know really what's worse because it affects the way people view things. So as much as I think that parents deserve to be included, and I would be very hurt if my son did not include me. I have a son who just got married a few months ago. I still encouraged him to speak to his rebbeim because I thought that that was a healthy balance. You can discuss it with me, but I would like you to have some objective outside parties giving you advice as well. I think that the need for a dating advisor is so major. And dating advisors don't have to be people who have an MSW or anything else. It has to be somebody who you consider a little bit at a different stage of life. I think the problem is sometimes we make our peers dating advisors, and that's often very not healthy. We need somebody in a different stage of life, married already. It could be somebody who knows you well. It could be somebody who you just think is insightful, even though they don't know you that well. But somebody who will make the time to try to give you some direction. I think that because there are a lot of busy people in the world today, we don't take advantage. It's not about calling the dating advisor about after every date. It's about saving it for opportunities. We need a lot of the growth here is our own processing and our own not becoming dependent on somebody, but be able to turn to them when there is something that is bothering me and to know that they'll be able to help me. It's worth developing a relationship with somebody in order to be able to have them as a dating advisor, even if you have to invest. Go help them cook for Shabbos on a Thursday night, offer to take their kids out, whatever it is, but to have somebody there who you feel is insightful, who can help you. I think that, I'm just saying this as a clause, but I think that often people who help us in Shidduchim, dating advisors and Shadchanim, often are not appreciated enough. And to keep up a good relationship with somebody, I think it's also important to make them know that you really appreciate their time. And offer them some help sometimes. Sometimes I feel that dating advisors get more Hakar Satov than Shadchanim. Because you're turning to them for their support. Shadchanim, you call them and you're worried about why they don't call you back, and then they call you and you might not like this idea, but you like that idea. And Shadchanim put a tremendous amount of effort into setting up. And for every 10 hours that they spend trying to think of you and connect you and everything, could be you went on one date and it didn't work out. But that doesn't mean that they didn't invest all those hours anyway. And it's so important. It's such a, it's such a position which is very often not thanked and not so appreciated. I'm not a shantan personally, but maybe a little more in the dating advising field. But something very beautiful happened to me once that I want to share with you. I had a certain boy, a very good boy, who was going out with one of my students. And the relationship didn't work out. But as these things sometimes happen, he started dating a girl from a different seminary who I didn't know, but he continued to call me. So I guess in a sense I became his dating advisor. One day, he was on the phone with me, and one of my children was crying in the background. He says to me, Mrs. Schoolmaker, what's the name of that child who's crying? And I told him. He says, and what's the name of your other children? And he told me. He said, well, you know why I'm asking? Because I daven for your children every single day. And it would be good for me to know their names. And I was so touched by that. It was so beautiful. Like, he was thinking, what could he do to return the favor for me? He'll daven for my family. And these are little things that we do, which are so meaningful to the people on the other end. And I think that if it's, you know, a woman who's helping you and you can help her out a little bit or offer her help or whatever that is, I think it's very thoughtful and it shows something about you that you can appreciate and reciprocate. Okay. Difficulty in opening up. This is sometimes what I call like when a relationship reaches a certain kind of like a dead end. And for many of us, this is not an easy part of dating. Especially if we've suffered from rejection a few times, we kind of develop a system with which we protect ourselves. I want to, okay, we don't have so much time, but, actually my watch stopped. One second, what time is it now? What's that? Thank you. It was 10 to 9. I'm like, wait, I haven't been speaking for more than 5 minutes. Yeah. No, 9:32 already. Wow, so we really do have to finish up. Okay, I'd like to share with you a certain idea very, very quickly. Actually, you know what? I'm trying to think if we have time because I have a few more things I'm supposed to say. Keep going? Okay, I want to make it, I want people to feel that they're, you know, I think you probably assume that we'd be finished by now. So if anybody wants to leave, please feel that you can. I don't want to feel like I'm holding anybody. I'll try to quickly go through the rest of my ideas. This idea is important than what I was going to say, but I'm going to go through it very, very quickly. There's a shita in understanding people, which talks about how people deal with an experience which was traumatic for them. And traumatic is not only the big capital T traumas in life. Something like a bad breakup could be very traumatic for a person. And the shita says that people have a certain way that they deal with traumatic experiences. So I'm going to give it there, these very cute little words so that you can remember the system. But it talks about the concept of an exile. When you have a traumatic experience, you often put that experience into exile, meaning that was such a terrible feeling, I don't want to ever, ever be there again. And therefore, that experience, which we're going to call in the context of dating, we're going to call it rejection or being hurt, becomes an exile, meaning I will do anything not to get to that place again. But when you put somebody in exile, you need to hold them in exile, right? And then we have what's called the managers or the jail keepers. This is based on a system called IFS, Internal Family System. And the gatekeepers are the system that I use in my own personality to make sure that I don't have to experience this bad feeling again. It's like the jail keeper who keeps the door locked and keeps the person in jail. The problem with keeping somebody in jail is that if you keep them in jail for a little bit of time, they're okay. The longer you keep them in jail, the more they're pushing to get out. And this is why people sometimes had a traumatic experience many, many years ago, and they're wondering why now they're still suffering from it, because this is very important. A processed trauma heals. A non-processed trauma could get worse with time. You can have an 80-year-old man who still is acting up based on an experience from when he was 2 years old, because his trauma was not processed, and it's like somebody who's been in jail for 78 years who wants to get out. So the jail keepers are the systems that we use to avoid the bad experience coming out, the traumatic feeling. Now, if a person has suffered rejection because they really invested and they felt very connected and they emotionally let themselves go, and then the person rejected them, so what would the jail keeper be? It could be intimacy avoidance. I'm not going to let anybody get that close to me, and I'm not going to have to feel rejected again. It's a good system. Another jail keeper could be sabotage. Same kind of family. Meaning, I do very well in the beginning of a relationship, but as soon as it starts getting a little too close for comfort, I'm going to do something or start seeing you in a critical way or whatever it is, because I can't stand to get to that point that I got to where I got broken up on, so I'm going to get there first. I'm going to make sure not to be in that here anymore. And this happens. And then there's the third level. And the third level is what we call the firefighters. Sorry for these like cute little terms. But the firefighters are what happens when the situation finally does come out. Because again, keep somebody in jail for a long time, they try to get a way out, their way out. What happens when here I am, and that situation that I was in once really managed, like, and in the context of dating, somebody managed to get my heart again. I can't believe it. I thought I'd never trust anybody again, and here he is, he's getting close. And then the firefighters come out, which is some kind of extreme reaction to deal with the fact that here I am back in the same situation. And that is sometimes things like incredible anxiety or some kind of immobilization, some kind of intense response. And these are the people who have been waiting so long to get connected, but then when they get connected, they're very, 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 very scared. Or there's something in their behavior which is like, ooh, over the top. By the way, I'm just putting in the context of dating, but this is true about anything. Somebody who suffered criticism when they were younger, for example, that could be the exile. I don't want to be criticized. The jail keeper is perfectionism, because if I'm perfect, then nobody will ever criticize me. And the firefighter is extreme anger. You ever catch me doing something wrong, I'm going to be really angry at you, or maybe really depressed, or maybe really something. So this kind of system works a lot with us. And I think that when we think about getting serious with somebody, sometimes we bring out our old traumas. And by the way, the old traumas don't even have to be in dating. That guy who I really liked who broke up. It could be somebody in your family of origin who you felt you couldn't trust. Or somebody you once got connected and then you got rejected. And the state is being, I have a fear of getting connected. So it's important to know about this. And here we're going to have to work with ourselves. First of all, just by embracing it and understanding it is already processing it. When we said a process, trauma heals. So sometimes I have to be able to call a spade and say, oh, this is what's going on with me. And I have to really work on getting past it. I talk about this, many of my students have heard me talk about this, but in terms of the opening up, many of us have a certain comfort zone. Meaning, to talk about, to basically connect on an early stage of a relationship, yeah, that I could do with anybody. As soon as a relationship starts demanding more of me, that's where it gets more complicated, especially if I have a fear of rejection or I'm not comfortable with closeness or whatever it is. And I tell people that the first step is that you're going to have to push yourself a little bit beyond your comfort zone. And this is a very big, it's very counterintuitive, I'll tell you why. Many people feel, if it was the right guy, I would want to open up. And that's not always so true, because old habits die hard. And new systems are hard to develop. So it could be that this person really has potential for me, but I am not naturally flowing with it. So I say to people, your first step is to challenge yourself a little bit above your comfort zone. Meaning, I am going to share with him something today that I don't naturally share with people. I'm going to compliment him today in a way that I don't usually give that kind of compliment. You know, it's very interesting. We all feel that we're very warm and loving and supportive. But then when I tell people, did you give them a compliment? They say, no. Like, I just asked them to, like, eat pig or something. I don't know. So, like, you know, we're nice and warm to the friends who we had 15 years of school that we acquired their friendship. But for new people, like, why should I make them feel good? And I tell people that in order to move a relationship out of its stuck place, you have to go beyond your comfort zone and say, today I'm actively deciding to share this with him or to compliment with these words, and I know it's not going to feel natural at first, but the point is that I'd like to get to a new place. And this is like, it's very counter, but it really has to be done, because if you're going to wait at your comfort zone, you often won't be willing to take a risk, and good results don't come without risks. Okay, I feel like it really should be winding down because people have to go. Red flags versus cold feet. I feel we have to talk about that for a second. It's so complicated when you're in a serious relationship and then you suddenly see something wrong. And you're wondering if it's your psyche playing tricks on you or if there really is something wrong. So let's just give a few quick tips about this. Rosie Einhorn, who wrote the books on dating and marriage, she once said to me that she asked people about what we call a chazaka, meaning, is this a new issue, or is this something that, in hindsight, you saw a lot over the relationship? Because if it's something that you've never seen and it's suddenly coming out of the woodworks a week before engagement, you have to ask yourself, and it's not, there's a concept called binding the anxiety, which means that when a person's about to make a life commitment, often there's like a free-floating anxiety around it. Now, a sophisticated psyche doesn't like to say, he's amazing, but I'm just jumping off the roof with anxiety, right? And I have two kinds of people who call me. Some people call me and say, he's in everything I ever wanted. I just know that I'm just I'm very nervous now because I have to make a life decision. That's easier to deal with. But some people call me and say, you know, I'm not sure if he's this enough for me or that enough for me. And in some cases, it's a real issue. And in some cases, it's binding the anxiety. Instead of a free-floating anxiety about making a life decision, they have to point to something in him which is making it difficult for them. And this is why we have to look carefully. And this is, by the way, one of the reasons why we need dating advisors. Because sometimes it's so hard to figure out, is this real? Is this imagined? How real is it? Okay. I look at that continuum to toolbox. I look at the chazaka. I look at the chisaron that they're pointing at. Is it really a red flag? And again, you know, many of us have heard from Shalom Task Force. And if you haven't, you should read about what red flags are in relationships. It's very important to know. Unfortunately, I feel that what happens today is that there are different types of people. There are the people who need to know more about red flags because they tend to fall into situations where the person is really problematic. And then, unfortunately, we have the people who, because the world is so complicated today, they're always seeing red flags. And we have to be able to, that's where a dating advisor and some kind of objective help is so important because, and thorough help. Not somebody's going to give you a 2-minute, like, marry him, that's it, what are you talking about? Somebody's going to listen to you and hear you out and ask you for examples and give you a context because it's very hard to make those distinctions. And I see more and more the other. I see that in today's world, we hear about abuse and we hear about these things, and then any perfect person, we're wondering if he's maybe an axe murderer in the closet, you know? And we have to realize that we have to balance ourselves out. So the naive people have to catch on to the red flags, and the overly vigilant people sometimes have to loosen up, but we need dating advisors for this as well. Okay. Okay, comparing, this is going to be my last point. Comparing to other relationships, past relationships, or wondering if I'm going out with somebody who's good enough because of who else is out there. And I think many of us know the famous part that they say about the Sheva Brachos, Sameach Tisamach Reim Ahovim, Ki Samechacha Yitzircha B'Gan Eden Mekedem. It's a very famous idea, which most of us know by now. We're giving the Chassid and Kala a bracha that they should be like Adam and Chava and Gan Eden. And who's to say that Adam and Chava were the happiest of couples? So the Vart says that Adam and Chava knew that they married the only person in the world for them, because they were the only people in the world. And we're giving the Chassid and Kala a bracha that they should feel like they're Adam and Chava and Gan Eden. I married the only person in the world for me. That feeling doesn't just come out of nowhere. That feeling starts on the very first date, when I'm relating to a person as an olam mala. And I say to people, you can tell me that he's not smart enough for you, but don't tell me he's not as smart as my brother. You could say, I'm not sure if he has this and this midos, but don't say the guy who I dated last week had better midos. Because those comparative words of better and as are already not treating a person like an olam mala. We definitely don't want the boy to compare us to his sister, his neighbor, somebody he went out with last week. So we have to make sure that whatever it is that we're looking at is an objective looking at the person and deciding if he's right for me. Nowhere is this as true as not comparing to the theoretical, virtual guy who's out there and I haven't even met him and dated him yet. Because that could go on forever and ever. There's always, you're not marrying the person who's the best in every area. You're marrying a person who is a configuration of a lot of different things and he's best for you. So we always want to take a person seriously, whoever we're dating now, and we have to remember what the Chazal say, Ein l'dayan ela et ma she'einav ro'ot. And this has very specific halachic connotations. When a dayan is sitting and making a din about something, he's not thinking about the information that he doesn't have. He has to deal with the information that's in front of him. And similarly, when I'm dating a person, I'm not thinking about the potential boys who I don't even know who might be there for me. This person is an Olam Mele. I look at him. He might be the right one. He might not be the right one. But not because I'm comparing him to somebody else. Okay. I wanted to leave room for some questions. I know that people want to go already. So I would like to leave maybe room for people who would like to leave to leave, people who want to ask questions to ask questions, and I'll give a few more minutes before we wrap up. Okay. Anybody have any questions that they're comfortable asking? You don't have to. I'm just looking through my notes to see if there's anything that I wanted to mention that I didn't. Oh, okay, there was one point that I wanted to make. Yes. Oh, yeah. I kind of treat friends like I treat parents. What do I mean? A friend wants to be included a little bit because they want to know what's going on with your life. And the secrecy of, like, you know, saying that you're going to the dentist for, like, months and months and months every night is, like, you know, when it's your best friend, it doesn't tend to work, right? But the idea being that I don't want to... I'm not getting advice from them, first of all, and I'm not sharing enough information that's going to make it difficult for them to be happy for me. So I always talk about, like, friends should have collusions with each other. We will let you know, you know, or I will only share, we will share with each other. We will not share too much information. I'll let you know basically what's going on or whatever it is, but, like, don't ask me questions. I won't ask you questions because I do feel that people get very confused by each other's information. If you need advice, it should be coming from a dating advisor. If you need to unload, find somebody to unload on. But just kind of, like, rehashing the same situation. First of all, we live in such a small community that people end up marrying people who their friends went out with and they know, you know, too much. But also because it's just hard. It puts a person in a situation where it's really hard to be happy for somebody when, you know, when you're having your own difficult sense. So I think that friends have to make a preconceived plan of kind of letting boundaries stay intact with knowing that I still care about this relationship. When you're including a parent in some basics, but you really also have a dating advisor, you're saying, I care about you. The fact that I'm not sharing every little detail here is not because I don't care about you. For a parent, it's because I don't want to decide to marry this person and you're going to forever be stuck with the fact that I didn't like something about him then. So there's a certain boundary that's there, but not because I don't care. And I will share a little bit, but not too much. I think it's a little harmful, the amount of sharing and names that fly around and information that flies around. Anybody else? Any other question? Yes. Yeah, okay. Good question. I think that one of the things that we want to say is like this. Parents deserve to be included for two reasons. First of all, because of the kibud of aim, if it's hurting them and it's important to them, we don't want to shut them out. On the second level, they did raise you, and they know things about you that other people don't know. Your dating advisor might never know certain things about you that your parents do. I always say to people, include your parents in a certain kind of a way. Mom, what do you think are the three most important qualities I should be looking for? Or what do you think about this and this? But not, you know, he did this and this and this, and I'm wondering if he's too obnoxious or whatever, you know. Because then you might marry him, and in her mind, he's forever obnoxious, right? You got over it, she's still there. It's like the girls who come home. You call home from camp, you're miserable. You're fine 3 minutes later, your mother's crying the whole week that you're miserable, right? That's just the way it goes. And this is the way it goes. You share your svekos, your parents are left with the svekos, and you're happily married to some great guy, and they think you married a not good guy. So we want to include them in the level of soliciting from them objective advice to make them feel important, and they are important, but that doesn't mean that I'm processing the whole relationship through their eyes. I also tell people, when you walk through the door, if you're walking back to your parents' house, think, what kind of information can I include with them that's not going to create this whole intensity of responses and judgments? It was a great day. He shared this with me. You know, this interesting thing about his family. It was so fascinating to find this, that, and there's so much that you could share that could make a parent feel involved without getting them involved in the sticky stuff. For friends, I think not even that much is necessary. But for parents, I think I have rahmanas on parents. We shut them out. We tell them they're not objective. They sit and they think about you all day. They deserve to be included, but in that way. Okay, so I hope that was helpful. Yes. Yeah.
Mm.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, okay. Okay, I'm so happy you brought that up because you're just triggering in me. Okay, the question. The question is just in general about even if you have the wants and needs, how do you know? In other words, like if somebody gives you an idea and there's no good reason to say no, but there's no good reason to say yes either, and people are telling you that it's not a good idea for you, and you made a point in the very beginning. What did you say before that? The first point you made? Yeah, you said something before. You said something that like triggered me to say something. I don't remember. Right. Oh, the reference something. Right. Okay. 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 Now you're reminding what I wanted to say. And after this, we're gonna wrap up. Okay. So first of all, in terms of the references, people are mezalzel a lot in reference things, and I understand why. But a lot of times, what I say to my students is the problem is that we also don't know how to ask good questions. I'll give you a few little tips. I often ignore all the names on the reference list. The neighbor, the aunt, this, the that, those are not the people that I call. I'd rather play a little Jewish geography and find that somebody who I know, who I could trust, who was a Rebbe in his yeshiva in Israel or whatever that was, you know, or knows him from a certain context, because I find that you get, when there's a rapport between the checker and the person who you're calling, it just goes on a whole different level. It's worth, 10 lists are not worth one phone call where you feel you get off the phone and, I caught something in the essence. I also feel, and I often like to say this, the way we check, we ask questions that are so benign that we don't really get information. I tell people, first of all, ask the person to describe you, to describe the person. It's called unsolicited responses. And when you say to somebody, you know, this comes from a marketing, it's something that's done in marketing. If you walk into a cafeteria and you're taking some kind of quality control thing for Duncan Hines cake, sorry to compare people for cake, and you say, is this cake moist? You're leading the people down the moist level. Oh, it's moist, it's not moist, whatever. When you say, can you give me three adjectives to describe this cake, because people will be honest if they can afford to be honest. So when you lead them with a specific question, you're not always going to get such honesty, but the three adjectives that they'll bring up are very often accurate. So it's worth doing it that way. And it's worth really having a rapport with the person you're checking or having somebody else. But I do think that the checking can really help in that way. Okay? I also still feel that, this is the other point I was going to make, and I'm going to end up with this. The person setting you up should have a good explanation of why they think it's good for you. And I often say, who's setting you up? If it's just, some lady who I don't know from anywhere just saw me in shul and said, why don't you go out with, you know, whatever, whatever. That I don't take so seriously. It's not like, why not? You could check into it. And like I said, sometimes your grandmother's hairdresser in Florida might come up with a good idea. She never met you. You never know who your shaliach is. But you're going to take it much more seriously in terms of the checking when you don't know the source. But I say a good shachin will have some reason why they thought it was good for you. And that I listen to much more carefully. Because there's no good reason to say no is different than saying, but is there a reason to say yes? And somebody who, and now again, a shachan might just say, try it. So you do the research and you might find that there's something great about him that's very good for you. But I find that shachanim in general often do good ones, have a reason. It's not just, there's a guy in town, sounds like it might be the right age for you, you know, but more like, I know what you're looking for and this is where your wants and needs help. And I know that the things that are on your needs list are there. And I think it's good for you for this way. Those things I take much more seriously. I think the checking has to be done regardless. But there's a very big difference in saying yes to everybody who walks over to you in shul and some gives you a name, and saying yes to somebody who's explaining to you in a more direct way why they think it's good for you. Both situations need good checking, but if the shasna has a reason why they think it's good, I take it more seriously. Okay? Great. Okay, I'm sorry, I feel that we went very over time, and I apologize, but I wish everybody a lot of hatzlacha, and thank you for reminding me. Okay, I just wanted to end with a parak tehillim for Refuah Shleima for Rafael Daniel Ben Fagel, who this event tonight is being sponsored as a Refuah Shleima for him. Okay, so we're just going to end with the Perek Tehillim and Shir Lamalot. Esa Enai El Harim Me'ayin Yavo Izri. Izri Me'im Adonai Oseh Shemayim Va'aretz. Al Yitein Lamot Reglecha Al Yanum Shomrecha. Hine Lo Yanum V'lo Yishan Shomer Yisrael. Adonai Shomrecha Adonai Tzilcha Al Yad Yiminecha. Yomam Hashemesh Lo Yakeka Ve'erech Balayla. Adonai Yishmorcha Mikol Ra Yishmor Es Nafshecha. Adonai Yishmor Tzeischa Uvoecha Me'atah V'ad Olam. Shavir Fu Shalema for Rafael Daniel Ben Feigl, Mitoch Shar Chalei Yisrael. Thank you very much, everybody. If anybody's interested in finding out more about the teleconferencing VAD, I have these cards here. So you're welcome to come take. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Yes, yes.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And everyone, just a quick reminder that normally on Monday nights we have the Rabbi's Halacha Shir. It takes place here at 7:30 on Monday nights with Rabbi Orlia, and we hope you can all attend that as well. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry? Here? At the Orlia? Why don't you come up here now?
I don't know if you should. No problem. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, are you done with that?
Yeah. This is the rabbis?
I don't know. Not even
a question. I think it's stopped. I don't know if that stops it or not.
I don't know either. I've never used it in my life.
Me I don't know.